I've alluded to the idea a lot, or Whitney and I both have, that we feel like the core of challenges in marriage are related to what we would call heart issues, just, you know, issues of the heart. So I felt like it would be worthwhile for us to dive in a little deeper about what we mean by that. And by the way, I actually think this is a really good night for not just our marriages, but just for our walks with the Lord. I think this is as applicable as anything. So I believe that all sin emanates from pride. I think pride is the center point of sin. Biblically, I think that plays itself out in tons and tons and tons of different ways. My favorite example of this is when Paul says, everything that is not from faith is sin. Well, I think over and over again, you can see the way the opposite of faith is pride. So, and let me tease out what I mean by that. So, I think we can all come to an agreement that thou shalt not lie is a commandment that is binding on Christians. Is everybody with me on this? Sin, does everybody believe it's a sin to lie? If anybody says Hebrew midwives, you have to leave, okay? We're not talking about that tonight. Or Rahab or something like that. I'm just kidding. We can talk about that. But sometime. Not here. They were hearty about this. Anyway, so thou shalt not lie. Well, I've lied before. I'm just going to get that out there. I'm sure all of us have at one point or another in our lives lied. So what does it take to lie? Well, you come to a moment, to a crossroads, and you've got two options, right? I can tell the truth, or I can lie. And more than likely, we choose to lie, unless we're, you know, habitual or even pathological liar. We're at a moment where we're saying, well, from my perspective, nothing makes more sense than lying right now. It's going to make my life easier. It's going to make me happier. Right? We're saying something, some reason we're lying, right? All the while, when you choose to lie, what do you know? God said, thou shalt not lie. And if you're a Christian, you believe God's in control. You believe God made the world. You believe God designed the world in such a way that in that moment, the best thing for you and for that person, for everyone else, is to tell the truth, right? And we believe that's true. If God is who God says he is and the Bible's true, if God said not to lie, the best thing to do is not to lie. So it takes a mini revolt in our hearts, right, to decide lying is a good decision. You know, it's sort of like if it's a bad thing to be a spy against your country. And if you decide, I'm going to spy anyway, you've decided you know better than whatever, and you pay the consequences. Well, we're saying, I have more wisdom than God in this moment, right? I don't trust God. I don't trust his word. I trust how I feel right now, and my vision of life says lying is good. It's the best thing for me to do right now, so I'm going to lie. So you start thinking about it like that, it's very clear how pride and faith are opposites, right? Faith would say, God, nothing right now seems worse than telling the truth. I can't imagine one thing worse than telling the truth. But I trust you and I trust your word. And so that's faith. And then lying says, I don't trust you. I don't trust your word. I trust my intuitions and instincts more. I'm going to lie. So pride, I think, is at the root of sin. We can walk through any scenario, right? And that holds up. Pride is the root of sin. And pride naturally is going to lead to what the Bible calls idolatry. And idolatry is having other gods before the Lord our God. And the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. And so anything that's short of that standard is idolatry. And for us, typically, I think actually all idolatry is a form of pride. Okay? I'm going somewhere with all this, so y'all hang in there and interrupt me with questions if you have them. I want to read a couple of verses from the Old Testament for y'all. Not as good at my Bible drills I used to be. I should have put my bookmarks in here. Yeah, that's right. I didn't go to First Baptist then.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awkward.
I know. Isn't that sad?
When did y'all start?
I was in sixth grade.
Oh.
Yeah, I was in middle school. Lindsay came obviously a lot younger, but I was...
Oh, okay.
She's like 7 years younger than me. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
All right. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 8. He's talking about Philistines or pagans. Let me back up into 7 and 8. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. Now, speech or language that's set against something, or argument that's set against something, that's meant to criticize something, is called a polemic. And so one of the common polemics against idolatry in the Old Testament is this idea that it's silly to worship something you made with your own hands, right? So that's a common theme. But there's actually another layer to it, I think, that you're worshiping the work of your own hands, and that's silly because it's something you fashioned out of wood. I think there's a couple of really... acerbic speeches throughout the Old Testament that talk about that. But I also think there's another, like, literal sense in which they're worshiping the work of their hands, right? If you start thinking about just idolatry proper and all the different gods, they typically represent something we do. You know, you talk about the God of the sea. Sure, there's a God of the sea, and that's not something we do, but he is very involved with the things we do in the sea, right? Fishing and all these different kinds of things. And so they reflect us, the pagan gods do. But let me flip over and kind of show you a place in the Bible where this idea draws that conclusion a little more tightly. It's the prophet Habakkuk, which just kind of reminds me when I was in high school, there's this kind of popular thing to do where like a preacher at a youth camp or something would be like, open your Bibles up to, you know, 2 Hezekiah. Everybody starts flipping, you know, and it's like not a book of the Bible. Habakkuk's actually a book of the Bible. I'm not pulling a prank here. This is Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 7. It's warning against the Babylonians coming to judge. God's going to use the Babylonians to judge Israel. If you've never read Habakkuk, it's so fascinating because Habakkuk is just stunned by the fact that God would use these godless people to judge his people. And so it's a really great book. If you've ever struggled with the problem of evil or anything like that, Habakkuk deals with it really directly and asks some really difficult questions. Gets an answer too, just so you know, but we'll let Habakkuk tell that story. I won't get into that tonight. But in talking about the Babylonians, these pagan people, Habakkuk says in verse 7, they are dreaded and fearsome, and their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. And then in verse 11, then they sweep on like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God, which is just such a good picture of this. And by the way, these guys were out and out pagans, but Habakkuk's getting to the root of the matter that they're worshiping their own power. Chapter 1, verse 16, he's talking about this pagan man catching fish, and he says, therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. So that's another example, I think, there of the point I'm trying to make, which is that pride is the root of sin, and that pride naturally produces idolatry in our hearts and lives. Okay? Is anybody tracing this argument with me so far? Is anybody tracking? So, if the Bible says we shall have no other gods before us, and our tendency in our sin is to put ourselves above God, to worship ourselves, to be prideful, then by our very nature, we have a tendency, a bent toward idolatry. Okay? So the base root issue in all of our hearts is our tendency to have other gods before the Lord our God, and primarily our own selves, our own pride, to elevate ourselves above God. And all of our heart issues are rooted in this. They're ultimately rooted in idolatry. So when I was in seminary, I got one of the best little sentences for how to diagnose if you have an idol in your life or not. When I was in college, I went on a mission trip to Chicago and outside Chicago in Wheaton, Illinois, which used to be called the Baptist Ghetto. I mean, people used to kind of jokingly call Wheaton the Baptist. I mean, there's tons of Christian publishers and all sorts of evangelical institutions that have historically been headquartered in Wheaton. And this would have been in 2007, I guess, 2006, 2007 when I was there. At that point already in Wheaton, Illinois, it was the largest Hindu temple outside of India in the world.
Wow.
All right, in the Baptist Ghetto, okay? And there were multiple churches in this once evangelical stronghold that had been converted into mosques and everything else. So the missionary we were working with on this mission trip to Chicago, he had a good relationship with the people at the mosque. He's trying to reach people there. I mean, at the temple. And if you've never been to a Hindu temple, I'm guessing most of you haven't, I've been to one. They're fascinating. I mean, it's like a mega church, okay? There's a cafeteria there. I mean, there's just all kinds of different things going on. It's a community center for Indian people in that area as well. But they let us come in, and they let us actually into the temple itself. It's set off apart from their family life center, for lack of a better term, right? The education space and everything else. The temple is an actual holy space for them, but they let us in. And so the missionary told us to go in, not to try to engage anybody, it would be inappropriate, and they wouldn't be able to go back in. But what he sent us in there to do was to prayer walk in this temple. And as we walked around, it was one of the craziest experiences of my life, because I was literally had the opportunity to watch people bow down before idols. You know what I mean? Like, you're literally watching people get on their knees and bow down and worship idols. And you can just feel the sort of spiritual darkness in that moment. And the challenge of that. And so I think in a room like this, a bunch of good Baptists, that we, when we hear idolatry, our mind automatically goes to that. What are you talking about, Matt? Like, I don't have any idols. I don't bow down and worship idols. So let me give you this little sentence that I got in seminary that might help you diagnose whether you have some idols in your life. You know, what I'm not saying is go home and check the curio cabinets and make sure you've not accidentally gotten a graven image somewhere or something like that. I will say, but okay, this is another aside. One time, has anybody in here ever read Knowing God by J.I. Packer? Yeah, it's a great book. Well, there's a whole section in Knowing God on graven images. And one of the points Packer makes is it's unwise at best. He might be even stronger than that, but I always say unwise at best to have images of Jesus, especially images of Jesus in worship. Well, let me just tell you something. You get in a room full of sweet old ladies, you start telling them they shouldn't have pictures of Jesus around, and it gets real hairy real quick, okay? So just so you know. So I'm not even at this point talking about whether or not you got a picture of Jesus in your house or something like that, which I don't think is necessarily always sinful and wrong, but something I would be careful with. Because of the second commandment. Here's a diagnostic tool for all of us to determine if we have any idols in your heart. It's probably an idol if you'll sin to get it, or if you'll sin if you don't. All right? Now, we might have some idols around, huh? If you'll sin to get it, or if you'll sin if you don't, and based on these kind of things I've said already, you start to think about it, and you start to think, okay, yeah, if I'll sin to get it, or if I'll sin if I don't, then that's something I've elevated above God in my life at some level. Something I'll sin for in that way. So I just want tonight for us to talk a little bit about the heart issues and how those are major, is the core issue in every marriage, or these heart issues, and in particular our idols. These things come out of our heart, okay? And I don't know how often y'all apologize. For me, it's pretty often. There's something coming up pretty much every day that I need to kind of deal with. And so I have a lot of experience with my instincts on apologies. And they're almost always, my heart is trying to blame something for why I've acted the way I've acted. My wife, the kids, my circumstances, whatever else. I'm trying to do anything but. Nobody wants to say, I've got a problem in here, and that's why I acted the way I acted. You know, it's not fun to say. I don't know if you've ever said it. It's not fun to say, this came from in here. You know, I'm lashing out about this because I've got a control issues in my heart. And I felt like you didn't do what I wanted you to do, and so I'm mad. Or with my kids, if I'm mad at one of my kids, it's a lot easier to say, well, you should be acting like that, instead of say, you know, actually, I'm frustrated with my shortcomings in life, and I thought you were reflecting my shortcoming in doing that, and so I lashed out a little worse than I would have otherwise, right? Because that's a problem I deal with, and so, well, that's kind of weird to say to your kid, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to, and that's hard to admit, that kind of thing is. I don't know if y'all do that or not. I get most frustrated with obviously, typically, we are going to get most frustrated with our kids when the thing they do reflects something that is a pet peeve of ours in our spouse's personality. But I've come to realize the worst things that we act, the most harsh I am with my kids, and I think this happens a lot, are with the things we hate most about ourselves. And it's almost like you think you can anger it out of them or something, but you can't. Well, that's two different things, right? When I'm called on to apologize, I'm trying oftentimes to... I'm oftentimes trying to blame something else, to find some excuse besides, I got a problem in here. This is a freebie for tonight. I think this is a major issue in our society. I feel like all of us are looking for something or someone to blame for the problems in the world, right? And what it feels like a lot of people are unwilling to say is that we are all the problem. Okay? Now, there are moral differences and things that happen. I'm not trying to say that. I'm not trying to say we don't need to call balls and strikes and call a spade, and there are things that are more wicked than others. I'm not trying to say that. But it does feel like there's a real dancing around. We have a sin problem as humanity. You know, we're looking for scapegoats. And everybody is, by the way. And I think that's a problem. And we all do it in our own hearts and lives. And we especially do it in our marriages. Right? If you wouldn't act like that, I wouldn't have to act like this. You know? And that's like a Matt Alexander all-time quote. You know? And, it's the kind of thing we tend to say. Jim is playing, football practice. I mean, playing flag football. We had football practice last night, and David Simmons is the head coach, and I'm the water boy, and not because David's not. I mean, we're just catching. So he's been great, but long. That wasn't like a knock. I thought it might sound like a knock. Dave's like, Matt, you stand over there while I cook, you know, you shut up. Can't even block. We don't need linemen, you know, or whatever. And so, long story short, some kid did something to another kid, and I think it was Jim that kind of, reacted. And then Dave was like, hey, don't do that, Jim. And Jim was like, well, he did this. And Dave was like, if everybody's just be better, we'll all be better, you know, or something like that. And I was like, I was just thinking, like, isn't it funny how even, like, right there in flag football, like, kids are doing the same things we do, trying to say, like, well, I'm only doing this. I know you're getting onto me, but why are you not getting onto them? At the end of the day, we all have heart issues, okay? And you cannot control. This is something, you know, I've said last night to some kids at football practice, including my own son, and then to another kid today. I've said, you know, you can't control anything. You just can't. I can't control what y'all do. You know, it's maybe the worst part of my job. You know, is I can't just say, hey, go do this, and everybody does it. Of course, I've always said, too, you know, it's a good reminder, if I could, everything would be a lot worse than it is. You know, I trust the Lord and the Spirit more than I trust me being able to control people. But I can't control circumstances. You know, I can't control the weather. I can't control traffic. I can't control how anybody acts. I can't control what somebody says to me. I can't control the news. I can't control social media. I can't control anything. I can't control how people speak to you. I can't control any of this stuff. The only thing I can control is how I respond to it. So, like, you can't control what your spouse does. You know, you can communicate about challenges we have. You can't control it. All we can do is control how we respond. And so, if we're not dealing with our own heart issues, right, we're always going to be trying to think through how to justify blame shift. So let me just mention a few common idols in marriage. And by the way, if anybody wants to chime in on something they struggle with, I would prefer us not to talk about things other people struggle with. That's their story to share. And frankly, I don't want to add any extra marital counseling to my calendar right now if I don't have to. And bear in mind, we are being recorded here, so even then, you may get found out if you start blame shifting. One common idol in marriage is a personal vision of morality. Now, what I'm not talking about is Christian, like, objective morality, right? Even though, by the way, morals can become an idol. Okay, I don't know if y'all have ever been around Southern Baptists before, but morals can become an idol, okay? I mean, we can really get into legalism, and which is the idolatry of morality. By the way, when I was in seminary, Beeson Divinity School did, in Birmingham, they did a chapel session, a semester of chapel on what was called the Barman Declaration, which was a declaration that a group of Christians made in Germany that was trying to differentiate the gospel of Jesus Christ from the German Christian movement, which was the way the Lutheran Church in Germany had been co-opted by Hitler and sort of made part of the Nazi regime and apparatus. And so in the president of the seminary I attended, I was one of his interns, and so we did some research for him for that talk he gave at Beeson that semester. On the Barman Declaration. So we were looking at all kinds of pre-World War II documents we could find. So we found a report from the 1936 Baptist World Congress, which was a gathering of all the Baptists in the world, came together in Berlin in 1936.
Wow.
Okay, good time to be there, right?
Wasn't that the Olympics?
I think that was the same year, yeah, but I think it was separate. But obviously the Nazi propaganda machine was trying to get as many things as possible. Berlin at this time, right? So there were some concerns that people shared about kind of how things were going. Bear in mind, this is 36 in Germany, so we're going to show some grace here. But one of the reports was talking about, I don't think we should show grace to Nazis, just so that's, you know, okay. golly, it's the world went for the... somebody's got a bot out there searching for Baptist pastors favorably mentioning Nazis or something. But don't worry, I'm going to say something bad about Nazis in a second. And Baptists, for that matter. So here we go. So long story short, one of the reports that came back from that Baptist World Congress was a favorable impression of Berlin in 1936. And basically what it said is, you know, there's all these concerns, but I was really impressed. Because there were no women wearing lipstick in the streets. Nobody was smoking on the street. Everything was clean and tidy and moral, and it feels like they're getting some things straightened out there, right? Now, for all of us now, looking back, it's horrifying, right? I mean, it's the ultimate example of straining a gnat and swallowing a camel times a million. And the gnat, turns out, wasn't even really a gnat. You know, I think we're cool lipstick now. And depending on what state you're in, if you're in North Carolina or Kentucky, pretty cool cigarettes. You know, helps the economy. And so hurts nobody, you know. And so pretty cool with it there. And so long story short, that has been an example for me since I read it. I mean, I'm sitting there in the library, in the archives in the library, so I'm sitting there just slack jaw. I just can't believe I'm reading this. And I'm reading it off the microfiche of the original newspaper, so it wasn't just a quote in the paper. I'm just stunned. And I think, but anyway, long story short, morality, right? Even our perceived morals, our personal moral standards can become an idol that make us miss major things sometimes. Well, the same thing happened in our marriage. We've alluded to this already, but let me just mention, like, we have to be really careful in assigning morality to things that are not biblical morality. So I think one point of contention in a marriage oftentimes is centers around the sentence, well, that's just not how I was raised, you know? And if you think about it, just the way we say that sounds really moral, doesn't it? I mean, it's kind of its own version of praying. That's just not the way we grew up, you know? And we can let that, if we elevate that, that becomes just that's really oftentimes a matter of preference. I'm not critiquing how you grew up. I'm sure it was great. You know what I mean? And but if we really get down to the bottom of it, that's not something we should elevate above what the Bible says. Or it doesn't necessarily mean the way we were raised is not necessarily better than the way our spouse was raised. We probably want to do some things different and some things the same from both sides of the family, right? I mean, we you know, we're talking about this recently, just some of the ways that, you know, we want those things to be the case. I was talking to somebody just the other day about how I talk to my kids a lot. My kids will say sometimes, you know, I'm sure some of y'all have experienced this too. They'll say, well, when I'm a parent, I'm going to do this, you know. And which I love that sentence. Whitney and I say all the time, we're the parents we used to judge. And so it's a lot of fun to hear people say things like that, you know, because whatever you're saying like that, more than likely you're going to go back on it. As soon as your kid flips their lid in a Walmart, you know, here comes the iPad. So, you know, watch the phone, please, you know, I don't care. Let the screen baby sit. I'm going to get kicked out of this Longhorn Steakhouse, dude, whatever. So, you know, my kids will say that, and I'll say usually something like, well, you will do some things differently. It probably won't be that, because you're probably going to not feel that way when you're my age. But what I always then say is, I hope you'll be a better dad than me. Like, I hope you'll do better. Like, I hope, right? Don't we all hope that for our kids? Like, I want my kids to be better than me. And, like, if my kids come home and they're like, hey, we're doing this differently, I'm not going to be like, well, what's wrong with the way I raised you? You know what I mean? You know, like, that's not a referendum on me, right? They're learning things. They're figuring things out. Even the way we raise our own children can raise to the point of being an idol if we're not careful, right? Something that we feel this strong defensiveness of. We need to be really careful about that. Where are we finding our identity is a huge question that revolves around the idea of idolatry. When we find ourselves, you know, when you feel something kind of poked at a little bit and it feels real tender and you find yourself kind of bowing up and wanting to get super defensive, you know, there's a chance you got an idol working in there, and I just be careful. So like a personal vision of morality, not biblical morality, but a personal vision of morality can become an idol in our marriages. Here's one. Sex can be an idol in marriage. I think we spent, you know, a long time the other night talking about how important sex is in marriage, but we can elevate it beyond what it really is. We can make it is the centerpiece of our intimacy, and it's a very important part of marriage, but it's not the only part of intimacy. It's not the only part of marriage. And so I have seen the sexual proclivities of a spouse, an opposite spouse, used to justify so many sins, I've lost count. You know? When we start to feel entitled to sex, when we start to feel like, you know, our society is so funny. I mean, we treat sex like water. Just the idea that somebody is not having sex in our culture is just the craziest thought that people could have. I mean, we have made sex such a part of our identity, you know? If you just think about, like, even just the way, like, virginity is portrayed in our culture. I mean, I'm sure y'all have seen the movie. Some of you have seen the movie. I'm sure many pagans in the room have seen the movie The 40-Year-Old Virgin, okay? And I won't go any further than that. I won't ask you. Yeah. But just the very idea of that is just crazy. You know what I mean? It's just crazy to think about this movie. 40 years old and they've never had sex. It's like the craziest idea in the world in our culture. It's just funny as soon as somebody reads the title in that way. To our culture. And so sex is a huge idol in our culture and society. You see that playing out in tons of different ways. And we have to be really careful and guarded against that in our own marriages. So when you start thinking about sin to get it, sin if you don't, I think we see all the kinds of ways that that idol wreaks havoc in our culture and can in our marriages as well. The idol of sex and sexuality. I just find that I think we all recognize just the romanticization of life in which we live. By the way, if you're ever just curious to dig in deep on some of this kind of stuff, I don't know how many of you guys are philosophically minded or want to think really deeply about how our cultural moment got to where it is. I mean, we're talking about this all the time. There's all this talk about, you know, and even for me, like, I feel older. I feel like 10 years older every day, you know? Like, every day I just am like, man, I am a pawpaw. Like, I'm an angry old man. I don't know if y'all have ever seen that Simpsons meme that's like, old man yells at sky or whatever, you know? Like, that's me every day, you know? I heard the word laboo-boo the other day, and I punched a hole in the wall. You know, I was just like, I'm just mad. I'm just kidding. But, like, I feel older every day. One time I did say, like, I can't tell if I hate TikTok or I'm old. I'm not sure yet. But I think I feel older every day, but I think I'm more and more, I think all of us in a lot of ways, especially as Christians, are looking at the world sort of like, how do we get to this moment? You know, I was born in 1985. I mean, I'm not old, but how do we get to a moment where it's become normal in lots of ways for a woman to genuinely say they've become a man and vice versa and lots of different things? Well, if you're interested in a more deeper, nuanced, thoughtful dive into that, Carl Truman has a book called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. It's a slog, but then he has a abbreviated version of it. What's the word for that? What's an abbreviated book? Abridged. Thank you so much. You've done a lot of reading, haven't you, Caroline? Was a Robbie Knock too. Is like a lot of things.
I'm a double in this.
Yeah, abridged. The abridged version of that is called Strange New World by Carl Truman. But he kind of traces the way that the history of ideas have brought us to this moment. But a huge part of that is the romanticization of the world and the way we view everything through a romantic lens. And then the ultimate good it feels like in modern society is being your true authentic self. You know, and sometimes I've heard this illustration before where it's sort of like, can you imagine walking up to like a Viking warrior and be like, do you feel like your true authentic self today, you know, or whatever? I don't like to be too mocking about that because part of the reason why we're able to even think this way is the fact that we're not all worried about dying from disease every day or whatever, you know? I mean, so I'm thankful for the luxury of the modern age, you know? I'm thankful to be living in a world where I have first world problems. Those are the ones I want. But at the same time, right, we can see the way, though, that that sort of true authentic self combined, this is part of Truman's argument, combined with viewing everything through the lens of romanticism, has elevated sexuality not just to an idol for the age, but it's now become the key part of our identities, right? I mean, it, maybe not us as Christians necessarily, but like the world around us, where if you look at someone who says they have X, Y, or Z sexual proclivities, and you say, I don't think you should do that. I think that's wrong. They're saying, you're saying I can't be my most true, authentic self, right? And we kind of want to mock the LGBTQ people for those thoughts, but we've fallen into that as well. You know, heterosexual Christian people too, and we can do this in our marriages if we're not careful, where we feel like sexual expression is necessary for us to be our full true selves, you know? What are we saying if that's true? That Jesus was never his true authentic self, right? Which obviously is a laughable thought. So we want to be really careful with the idol of sex. I'm going to try to get less cerebral here. Time, our time. When you get married, your time is no longer just your time. Your time is our time, okay? And I think this is especially difficult in childbearing years. It's really hard for Whitney and I in the years when our kids were little. Because by the nature of her being the kid's mother, it was harder for her to get away from them than it was for me. Okay? I mean, it's just, she nursed them and just, there's just, it's just part of it. And it's just a little more difficult. And so we have to be really careful in how we think about time and remember that my time is our time. Now, I don't think we should be selfish and never give our spouse time away, but we can start to hold to our time and turn it into an idol if we're not careful. And that could be a hard issue that we lash out about. Okay? Hobbies is another thing that's kind of more related to time, but we can sometimes, you know, get angry with each other about not having the time we want to do the things we want to do. I don't know about y'all. Are y'all this way? I like to do what I like to do. Anybody else here like that? Anybody else enjoy the things you like? I mean, I do. And I get frustrated when I can't do what I want to do. You know what I mean? I do. Is anybody else this way? Yeah, we're all this way, right? Everybody wants to do what they want to do. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But when we elevate it to something we feel entitled to or something that belongs to us, we can make it into an idol. Money, the way we deal with money, the love of money, greed, all those different kind of things, when money becomes an idol, it can do really great damage to our marriage. And so, but you notice I'm talking about some of the big stuff here. What about parenting and kids? Our children can become idols for us. We can put our children above our marriage. We can put our children above all kinds of things. I want to tell y'all something. Besides like the obvious stuff, like, I'm just assuming nobody here is going to abuse their children. You know, like that's the worst thing I think you can do to a kid. But besides the major stuff, maybe one of the worst things we can do to our kids is to make an idol of them. Only one being in the cosmos can handle being worshipped. Only one. If you think about it, like, what? Okay, we worship God, right? Love God, trust God. I put all my eggs in the Jesus basket. All right? It's my whole deal. My career, my livelihood, my future, everything belongs to Christ. And if you're a Christian, you've done the same thing. It may not look just like it does for me because my career is wrapped up in it. But for all of us, right? Paul says, if there is no resurrection of the dead, we have all been most to be pitied. We're crazies if Jesus isn't alive. And in your darkest moments, in your most difficult moments, you've leaned in on Christ. And everyone here at some point has probably said, but at least I know I've got Jesus, or at least I know there's going to be heaven, or whatever else. What would it be like if Jesus let you down? Yeah. If you just realize he wasn't who he said he was. It would be devastating, right? But he can handle worship. Why? And we should worship him because he cannot let us down. He cannot deny himself. He can't let us go. So he can handle our worship because there's never going to be a moment when he lets us down. Now, imagine this. Imagine you're a child and you are the center of your parents' world. All their hopes and dreams are riding on you. They hold you up on this pedestal and then you let your parents down and you've been worshipped by them for years. Right? That is unsustainable. I mean, it's ruining. It's ruinous for children often. And you wind up putting them under this yoke of feeling this need to perform all the time and to make mom and dad perfectly happy and everything else. It feels sometimes like it's good to elevate your kids and make them the best thing or the most important thing in the universe to you or whatever else. We talk about it like that's all that you should do. But in the end, that can be really, really, really difficult for kids. Now, don't underlove your kids, okay? Let me just make that sure. You know, you don't want to, like, you know, try to prove to them they're not an idol all the time. Hey, stupid, see? No worship here, you know, or whatever. I mean, we don't want to do that. But I hope you get the point that I'm trying to make. Our career, we can sometimes, you know, make an idol of our career. I'll just say I've done that before. It is really, really easy to do in ministry, you know, because you can justify every single thing you do. Because I work for Jesus, you know what I mean? And so I can be like, you know, if my wife's like, hey, I feel like we're kind of getting leftovers here a little bit. I was like, don't you care about Christ's church? You know, I mean, I can kind of do that kind of thing. I don't know if I've ever done it quite like that, but I've implied it, you know. And in the early days of my ministry here, Whitney rightfully, lovingly confronted me and said almost exactly that. She said, it feels like you're coming home and we get your leftovers. And in my heart and mind, I was thinking the whole time, well, I feel like the church is at stake. The future of this church is at stake and the glory of God is at stake and all kinds of things are at stake. And so I felt justified in spending the best part and all of my energy serving the Lord. But then it dawned on me, if I serve the Lord at the expense of serving my family well, then I've not really served the Lord. That's too high a price to pay. So now I tell our staff all the time, somebody already died for the church, so you can take a nap. You know, like it's okay. It's taken care of. So I would have said, let me back up though and say how it was an idol. I would have said with my mouth, I did say with my mouth, all those things I just said. Well, I'm just doing this because for the glory of God, zealous to see people saved. And there's obviously some level of truth to that. That is a big part of it. But an idol had creeped in under that I was also deeply scared of failure. Right? I was deeply afraid of the embarrassment of having to leave Gadsden, Alabama with my tail between my legs because I didn't succeed. I was deeply afraid of it not working, of things not working out. I was deeply, deeply, deeply afraid of going through the shame of losing my job or the shame of feeling like the church didn't turn around. I mean, I would get up in the morning and say, you know, look in the mirror and say, you're the last pastor of First Baptist Church, you know? And I was deeply fearful of being the last pastor of First Baptist Church and what people would say and all those kinds of things. That was not me glorifying God and trying to glorify Jesus. That was me making an idol of my career. And at the expense of my family. And it's probably Ford's first year of life. So that would have been my biggest regret as a father and husband is that year. July 2013 to sometime in 2014. And it was almost 100% because I'd idolized being successful as a pastor. Now, how silly does that sound? You know, that sounds so silly to say. Like, it's like, so you're telling me that you cared like more about, you know, succeeding as a pastor than you did your own family in those days? Yeah, I do feel like that. Now, Whitney, if Whitney was here, she would be like, oh, it wasn't quite that extreme or something, but I felt that way a lot of ways. So, long story short, they're all, it's easy to make a good thing an idol, if not easier to make a good thing an idol than it is to make a hard thing an idol. Or a bad thing, a sinful thing. And I think that's important for us to remember. So those are all like potential things that I see happen a lot in marriages, including my own, where we can sin to get it and sin if we don't. Let me just give you a few thoughts on how to fight idolatry, in particular in our marriages. Here's number one: reflect on, be enamored with, don't ever forget the bigness of God. I feel like the reason I'm sitting in this room right now, I think God called me, but I always like to think through what are the means by which God calls somebody to this kind of work. The means by which God called me to this work was when I finally got some level of a grasp of the bigness of God, and the gospel gripped my life, and how big, it's just bigger than anything else. I realized I can't do anything else. And so when Jesus is big, everything else tends to shrink, right? When Jesus is small, everything else tends to get bigger. And so this is part of what I'm trying to do every Sunday in the way I preach, is give you guys a vision of how big and great God is. Rightfully, I got some criticism early in my ministry that my sermons were low on application, and I did need to grow and make it more application. But if I had to choose every week between giving this hard practical application and giving you a vision of the glory and the bigness and the grandeur of God, I'll choose the latter every single time, because until we get a vision of how big God is, these idols are never going to shrink for us, and we're never actually going to become more godly. We can follow rules all day, right, and tips and all this kind of stuff all day, but until God is bigger than how we feel that day, until God is bigger than our problems, until God is bigger than everything, the problems in the world, in our hearts and minds, idols are going to have a breeding ground to get bigger. And we're going to be tempted constantly to glorify ourselves over God. Second of all, remind ourselves and preach the gospel to ourselves every day. Nothing kills idols like the gospel. Because if you think about it, an idol has a tendency to grow. Our pride has a tendency to grow. Because, I mean, you think about what I've talked about already so far tonight. Like, fear is a big thing. Fear of failure. Fear of being exposed. You know? Most of the lies of my life have been me being afraid that somebody was going to figure out that I'm not as godly as I think I should be. Or people are going to figure something out about me. People are going to get in on Matt's not the best guy in the world. I feel like I should tell you all that right now. I'm not the best guy in the world, okay? I know it's going to be hard for some of you to hear, but it's true. When we're trying to protect ourselves, right, we're missing the gospel. Because at the cross, what happened? The worst thing in the world that can be said about us was said at the cross. Okay? What's being said? Matt Alexander is so bad that the perfect Son of God had to die for his sins. That's how wicked I am. He's like desperately wicked. And so Jesus had to die for me. And he was stripped naked and beaten because of me, because of my sin. That's how wicked I am. That's how bad I am. So the worst thing could ever be said about me is I'm so bad I need a Savior named Jesus, right? So every Sunday morning when the cross is in the sanctuary, you look up at the cross. That saying, the worst thing to be said about you is said at the cross. And simultaneously, right? So that frees us from feeling like we have to defend ourselves all the time or whatever else. Once you put faith and trust in Jesus, once you make that decision, right? You're saying, I am bad and God knows it and loves me anyway. Therefore, I don't really have to worry about what people think. At the same time, at the cross, the best thing that could be said about you is being said. Right? What praise and adulation is there from people that's better than you are beloved of God and he loves you enough to send his son to die on the cross for you? Right? So the gospel kills our idols because we're no longer having a posture to make ourselves seem better and more successful and more wonderful, because the best thing that can be said about us is already said. And we're no longer having to be defensive and hedge and hide and all these kind of things, because the worst things already been said. We are simultaneously exposed and beloved in Christ. And that's really important. And then finally, work, preach the gospel yourself. Get a vision of how big God is. And then finally, humble yourself. Humble yourself every day after the model of Christ. Pursue humility. And as we humble ourselves and put on the attitude of Jesus through the work of the gospel and through faith and trust in Jesus, that pride is going to go away. We're going to crucify our flesh and the things that we're so defensive about and angry about and everything else are